army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and a regular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. Today, I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together.
So this is Bill, and welcome to episode 69 of Chasing Ghost, an Irregular Warfare podcast. This one is entitled The CG Mailbag, Question Time and the Backbencher's Lament. So a little bit of housekeeping before we get started. I'm going on vacation, and I hope to enjoy it, but nonetheless, I am trying to maintain my fortnightly cadence. So you will be receiving this sometime after I have recorded. Who knows if an asteroid has struck the planet or news starts to consume the netiverse in a fashion that would maybe make this irrelevant, but I suppose not. Another thing I wanted to bring up was that Chris at Podsworth, I've been using his program and spent a fairly considerable amount of money on upgrading all the audio quality of every episode I have ever published on Chasing Ghost and on War Notes. So I wanted to put a shout out to him if for any reason my listeners, either themselves as podcasters, or would like to make the recommendation to podcasts that they happen to listen to whose audio quality is suspect or in question or inferior, Chris at podsworth.com, he has the answer. This is not a paid advertisement, by the way. I'm doing this because of such a splendid job that has been done to upgrade the quality of my podcast, because not only am I a podcast producer, I'm also a podcast consumer. So I find that if the sound quality is bad or just almost unlistenable, I'm not going to listen to another minute. So some folks brought that to my attention. This is a mailbag episode, so I have gotten questions and correspondence over the past, since I started this podcast in 2022, over improving my sound quality. And over time, I think that it has improved. I've improved equipment. Over time, you find that with any new avocation one takes on, you get better and better with that over time. And I hope that is the case here. Now, I haven't done a mailbag. Well, I've only done one previously, and that was episode 17, Memorial Day Mailbag, which was broadcast in May 2023, may have been June 2023. And I figured with the correspondence that I get from members of my excellent audience, I wanted to address some of those questions. I try to respond to those questions at my CG podcast at pm.me or on my Substack. I've noticed that there has been a severe reduction in the comments sections whenever I publish a podcast episode. Makes me sad, but there it is. Because I started the Substack in the first place in order to have a conversation about these episodes after they're published, where I get feedback, recommendations, questions, maybe even answers I'm not aware of. So with that, let's get started and we'll dive into it. So the first question is from TM. And he says, and I think this is a result of my Storming America series, especially in the last two episodes of that series, where I had a lot of folks saying, well, what can we do about this? How can we protect ourselves? And let's see, that was episodes 49 and 50. Storming America TTP to Make You Free, parts 1 and 2. And also when I did the episodes 58 and 59 on the Mexican cartel conundrum, War Without End, parts 1 and 2, I got correspondents and listeners who wrote into me and said, hey, Bill, what's the weapons selection that you would recommend for personally provisioning the protection of you and your family, neighbors, colleagues, friends, whatever the case may be. So I will share some of that with you. My small arms expertise is divined from both my military service and my hobbyist interest in it. I've built rifles, I have employed pistols, and I have done all the things to include having my own personal night vision and armor and things like that. So my recommendations when it comes to weapons is that I am a dyed-in-the-wool fan of the Stoner platform, Eugene Stoner's AR system that he developed first in the 1950s. And until they come up with the 40-watt plasma rifle, I don't think I'm going to find an adequate replacement for this. Now, mind you, when I make these recommendations, if you happen to be an aficionado of anything from a Krag Jorgensen from the 19th century as your primary firearm, you are going to employ in this century to protect you and yours. That's up to you. If you happen to love the Kalashnikov, and I think the Kalashnikov's a fantastic weapon system for a variety of reasons. And I think that best of breed for those happens to be the Finnish Valmet and the Israeli Galil, which, by the way, sort of stole a lot of the details for that Israeli design from that Finnish Valmet. That Finnish Valmet is probably the best representation, apart from the fact that it didn't come with a Picatinny rail on the top, of the best implementation of the Kalashnikov action. At one time, thanks to Boston Tea Party's book on guns, Boston's Gun Bible, which succeeded on my nightstand, the aging and not very well aging Mel Tappan book, Survival Guns, which harkens back to the 70s and 80s, Boston Tea Party, otherwise known as Kenneth Royce, was the one who inspired me. He and I happened to be friends. And he's the one who inspired me to sort of make the switch at the time. And here's what happened when it came to long guns, is that while I am a booster of the AR platform for a while, I was very interested in the rifle caliber 308. And I managed to build, along with a friend of mine who goes by the initials SL, shout out to you, SL, the formidable and reputable FNFAL, which is the Fabrique Nationale Fusilier Automatique Légère, which was the right arm of the free world. So we built those, and every child left the house, three sons, two daughters, with an FAL that I had fabricated for them and a Glock. And then we discover that the 308 cartridge, because of 5.56 advances and problems between the sexes as far as fielding and bearing and actually driving properly a rifle, I went to more lightweight rifles like the 5.56. Doesn't mean I got rid of all of those, but I did manage to transition my FALs to the 308 platform in the AR, and I do have that, but my primary go-to rifle now at this point in the year of our Lord 2025 would be the Stoner platform, the AR-15. Once you get one, you need to have several, and I do have several. I have a light left-handed one that I built for my bride. I have two other light ones. I have a variety of other heavy versions depending on the mission set that I'm trying to accomplish with said rifle. I think it was someone who said that a pistol is what you use to get to your rifle. I think that there's truth in that. And the technology that we presently have when it comes to the AR-15 and the ubiquity of the modifications and options and relatively inexpensive prices on putting together the platform and the Lego-like formation of an AR, to me, makes it the superior firearm in the West, particularly in the United States, to provide for your rifle needs out to 800 meters, which is the effective range of the 5.56 cartridge. The 5.56 cartridge tends to take the 55 grain or 62 grain cartridge, but they do have some that are like the 77 grain cartridge that may nose out that effective range a little beyond 800 meters, but I suspect not when it comes to going beyond 800 meters. I discovered, and Boston Tea Party points this out in his book, he has five levels of accuracy, and those top levels where one would find what's called F-class shooting today, which is shooting beyond 1,000 meters, extremely long range and such. We have shooters out there that have built guns, impractical guns, by the way, but it's their avocation nonetheless, that have shot out to 3 miles accurately on a piece of steel out beyond that 3 miles. Amazing. I did have a .338 Lapua Magnum at one time. I am fond of bolt guns, the Remington 700 in a Magpul stock is my preference. I have them in folding stocks and fixed stocks in the, I think it's a Magpul Pro Series. That's the one. A bit heavy, but nonetheless, I'm sold on those. So when it comes to rifles, I have settled on the 6.5 Creedmoor and the 308 and the 30-06 as the biggest cartridges that I'm going to field. As my oldest son would say, the 6.5 Creedmoor in the right platform, and he has spent thousands of dollars on building some of his very accurate 6.5s, is that it is boringly accurate. Now, what this also speaks to is optics, and we haven't talked about pistols yet, but we will. Now, when it comes to optics, it is always my recommendation that you spend the maximum amount of money that you can on the optic and the maximum amount of money that you can on a monolithic mount. So that means that not individual scope rings, even though if that does interest you, spend the money for something like Badger Ordnance or the more expensive ones to get the proper mating that you need between that optic and the rifle. Because think about this, the money that you spend on that monolithic, usually I have quick releases on all of mine, on that monolithic rail modality that actually holds your optic, is that you need to make sure that that marriage is one in which it is very finely tuned so that the weapon below the optic and the optic atop that monolithic scope mount gives you the finest accuracy that you can get. I happen to love my Vortex optics. I tend to favor, when it comes to rifle, the Vortex Razor LPVO, the low-powered variable optic. I have a 1-6 Echo 2, which is a lighter version of the earlier versions of that. And I also have the Razer Gen 3 1-10x24, and I really like that one. The problem with these Razer scopes for the AR is that they're rather spendy. You're going to spend between $1,500 and $2,000 just for that scope for a mount. If it's from ADM, which I think hits a sweet spot when it comes to expenditure for that monolithic quick release mount that I talked to you about for mounting on your Picatinny rail on the rifle, for mounting your optic, I really dig American Defense Manufacturing. But on my other ones, for instance, some of my bolts, especially my 6.5, I use a Spur, which is an SPUHR, spendy. $400 is probably the low end for one of those. When you look at bipods, for instance, I do love the Magpul bipods. I don't put bipods on all of my rifles, but on my 6.5 and my bolts, if I do have one, it tends to be a rather spendy bipod, like an AccuTac. And what I found is that if you have a $10 head, you get a $10 helmet. And if I can have gone through the stupid taxes of discovering what works and what doesn't work, and you find that some of my recommendations are worthwhile, great. I hope you learned from my stupid taxes for the things that I have that were less than optimal, suboptimal. For instance, when it comes to pistol, it it appears that all of us have a box of holster woe in which we simply haven't found the right holster until we finally laid hands on that one that has not only the quality and price intersection that allows us to buy more than one, but simply works for whatever we happen to use. I use Magpul magazines for all my AR platforms. I just so happen to also have Magpul stocks for most of my bolt guns, and with those can also be magazine fed. When it comes to triggers and trigger mods, what I like to do with my AR platforms is I use an ALG ACT, which is a polished and tuned mil-spec AR trigger. And the reason that I do that, and you'll hear me say this a little bit when we talk about pistols, is that the KISS principle, keep it simple, stupid, is something that informs me when it comes to this, so that when I have the unconscious competence through battle drills and training, whether with rounds going downrange or dry fire, and in this case, it would be on the AR rifle platform, I find that I want to have that kind of trigger press that would be identical to, let's say, a battlefield pickup, where I just so happen, if things really go awry and happen to pick up an AR or an M4 M16 that's on the ground, it will mimic as best as possible that mil-spec trigger so that I don't have to retrain myself when it comes to what I have to do when it comes to driving that rifle. When it comes to the fore end, I tend to use Midwest Industries, which has the integrated or integral attaching mechanisms for my Magpul MS4 sling. So whether it's a shotgun, which is the last in my pyramid of weapons that I want to use, all of my slings are universalized so that they're identical on all of the rifles that I have, to include the bolt guns. My favorite stock for an AR is the Magpul UBR. Love that. And I try to get the most vertical grip possible, so I traded out all of those. And you will find that when you're driving the rifle at the range in practice, or if you find your way on a two-way range, the more vertical that pistol grip, the more comfortable and accurate you are going to be under fire or firing at a pleasant and peaceful firing range in either the prone position, the seated position, the kneeling position, or if you happen to be standing up and firing. Now, I have been exposed to a lot of different kind of rifle platforms as a result of being a trainee, a trainer, and eventually a shoot boss in the Appleseed Marksmanship Project program, which I recommend anybody who hasn't attended it, no matter how competent you think you may be as a rifleman, to attend it. And by the way, if you happen to be a competent rifleman, then do your time in the training pathway, find your way to that top position of shoot boss, and you'll get a lot of satisfaction from having trained hundreds of people how to fire their rifles well, and also to teach them the marksmanship aspect to liberty when you discuss in the Appleseed Project how the marriage of liberty and marksmanship played out April of 1775 with Lexington and Concord and the beginning of the divorce proceedings from the United Kingdom in that fateful summer. So I think when it comes to rifle, I'm going to conclude with that that wheelbarrow full of recommendation, that and the price of some of that burned and bitter coffee at Starbucks is the worth of this advice. It's up to you and where you want to go, what you want to do, and how much money you want to spend. But in the end, the first question that you need to ask yourself if you're rifling up and you want to drive that rifle effectively is you always ask yourself, what is my mission statement for employing this platform? And if you answer that, all the follow-on questions should come logically after that, and then you can address exactly what fits your needs. Pistol. When it comes to pistol, I bought my first Glock in 1991, haven't looked back, always use Glock, with the exception of a .22 long rifle training pistol that I have, which is a Ruger Mark II, which looks like a Luger variant, or at least they stole that design. I suspect that the Luger design heavily influenced Ruger coming out with the Mark IV. Now, in this case, do not buy a Mark I, II, or III, or you will be on suicide watch every time you're trying to maintain that, unless you make some modifications to it. They finally managed with the Mark IV to take care of the disassembly problem that had plagued this pistol for decades, and I find as a .22 long rifle plinker, man, it's just it's a terrific weapon. I know that Glock came out with a .22 long rifle variant. Haven't used it, haven't tried it, I just don't know much about it, but I love this particular outlier to my Glock Armada. So I carry a Glock 19 EDC every day when I'm out and about, when I'm at home. I always have one at home. My wife, she christened it Mexican Dick Carry, which is MDC, and all it is for my Glock pistol is that it is a trigger guard with a lanyard that goes through my belt, and I carry what's called appendix inside the waistband carry. And all that means is that I have a belt buckle on, and at the 1 to 2 o'clock position, I have my Glock there with the trigger covered. Now, mind you, I have a Tier 1 system, which is a magazine sidecar and a fixed holster that can fit through your belt loops, in which you can carry it that way. And I still have a flat enough stomach, even at my advanced age, to be able to rock that. But I find that for convenience and, by the way, laziness sake, my MDC with that lanyard and the trigger cover, it just goes with me everywhere. And it's so bloody simple. The only thing that I haven't figured out for optimization is I haven't found a way to use the MDC with a flashlight attached. For instance, my youngest son, who is probably the most talented shooter in the family and the most well-accoutred for the most part, excepting dear old dad, he rocks a flashlight on his Glock 19 or his Glock 34, whatever his preference may be. My Glock preferences, I love 9mm. I started out on the 23 and the 22, which were 40 Smith & Wesson. 40 Smith & Wesson has gone out of favor. I still have those. As a matter of fact, I have a brace, which means two now hard-to-find Glock 24s, which are 6-inch barreled 40 Smith & Wesson pistols. As a matter of fact, I even got custom barrels for them, which is very nice. Those are my go-to-war guns, if it ever comes to that, and I'm praying that it never comes to that. So I have a number of Glocks that I don't always use, but I have a large collection. My EDC is a Glock 19. I've made significant mods to it, and I like the 19X, but because I am not the largest person in the world, I find that when I AIWB the 19X, sometimes I can, it will shadow out of my clothing where it will show that I'm actually carrying something because of just the slight length of that magazine extending out. And I don't use extended magazines when it comes to that. I use the ones that actually fit in the gun. I do carry spares that are 17, 19, or 21 rounds. So my favorite is the 19. I do like the 34. I do like the 19X, but the one that I carry every day, all the time, whether at home or outside the home, is the Glock 19. The mods that I make to the Glock 19 are I always put on iron sights, I always have the slides milled, and I always rock a Holosun. A 508T is the one that I use for my social work EDC. I'm sold on Holosun. Used to use Trijicon, but Trijicon, like HK, hates civilian customers, and they treated me in such a bad fashion for one of my Trijicon red dots for the pistol that had stopped functioning correctly. I said, never again. I've gone to Holosun. Yes, they're made in China. I realize they're Chinesium, but nonetheless, Holosun probably at the lower to medium end of the spectrum when it comes to price dominates what I have on my pistols. I tend to employ the smaller Holosuns in the 400 series for some of my other guns that I don't always carry. But if I'm carrying on a consistent basis, the 508T, which means titanium, is my preference. Love the red dot. The red dot has changed my life. I find that with my aging eyes and as I get older, I am more and more accurate with that. My youngest son and I, who is the one that I have trained with the most, and he and I have consistently attended courses like Gamma Resolutions, which is tremendous, based out of Florida. And wow, he just does a great job with it. Bob Keller runs that. He's a former assaulter with CAG, and I love his KISS principle when it comes to firearms training. What he calls a ready-up drill, which is simply that you have it in position Sewell if it's not in the holster. Ready-up means that you are on target and you are firing. He's the one who turned on my entire family to 3-inch black dots as the primary drill mechanism for practicing with these and achieving that unconscious competence that we want to have so that when we have to conduct social work with a pistol in the great outdoors or within our homes, God's willing that doesn't happen, that we can do it very effectively. Aim small, miss small. Hell, I buy 500 of those targets at a time and have many in my garage, but we've spent a lot of time both dry fire and in actual fire at the range, and it's absolutely necessary. So I make sure that the slide is cut so that I can put a red dot on it. I don't think there's any pistol that I currently employ excepting my Glock 21, which is the finest 45 ACP fighting pistol that was ever produced in the history of mankind that does not sport a red dot. I had mentioned that I like Holosun for the red dots. That dominates on all my pistol optics. When it comes to my rifle optics, I had mentioned the Vortex Razor, but putting $1,500 to $2,500 optics on all of your ARs is an expensive proposition. And I found that when it came to the quality and price spectrum, the Holosun 510 Charlie with a red dot is my go-to for mounting on my other ARs where I don't want to spend that much on an optic. I have an EOTech optic on mine also because I have an ASDIG, and it also allows me to use the EOTech because it has an infrared capability that could be coupled with my NODs, and those NODs are coupled with a helmet, an OpsCore, a high cut, and such. So back to pistol. The other mods that I make is that I not only do I get the slide cut, not only do I sport a red dot, but for the most part, I don't dispose of the Glock OEM barrels, and I'm not throwing shade at them because I think they're wonderful. But for the most part, I tend to have higher grade barrels. For instance, my EDC has a KKM. I suspect that KKM, they are spendy, is probably one of the best and most accurate barrels out there. But even with an OEM Glock barrel, I will never, ever be more accurate than my Glock. But nonetheless, I have gotten, I think it's S2F barrels and Blacklist barrels and the KKMs. Those are my three primary go-to barrel selections for aftermarket. I always put in an aftermarket extended detent for taking the slide down that's located above and just in front of the trigger, where one can take that slide off of the lower frame of a Glock to do maintenance if you have to. I always try to put on that little hollow space that is down there to the rear of the magazine. Always try to put a plug in there. Glock had their reasons for having that, but I prefer to have a plug there. That is probably the extent of my mods, excepting that I try to have 3.5-pound triggers in every one of mine. For instance, when you buy a Glock 34, it comes with a 3.5-pound trigger. When you buy some of their other models, they're 5.5-pound triggers. But to get that connector, that 3.5-pound connector, probably cost you maybe $25. I wouldn't spend a lot of money on triggers, but I think getting aftermarket connectors would be a good idea. So, wow, I've occupied a lot of this this podcast. I could talk all day about weapons, but nonetheless, here we are. So that's it for rifle or pistol. Please, if I missed anything or I tickled your fancy by not examining something deep enough, please, by correspondence on the Substack, or you can email me at cgpodcast@pm.me. Ask me questions. Tell me what you think. Or maybe you have a better way of conducting your business when it comes to rifle and pistol. I did want to do a shout out to SIG, which I just absolutely despise what SIG has done with the P220 and by extension the M17, M18 pistols that have been adopted by the U.S. military. The fact that these uncommanded discharges and having a pistol go off in your holster without you pressing the trigger, and SIG's behavior when it comes to this whole thing, please, if you happen to be a SIGger, do not AIWB that SIG, because guess what? Your family jewels are down below, and every time you do that, if they could scream, they would. BT sends a question where he says, how do you fix the defense acquisition system? So as most of you know who are perennial listeners, you know that I did a Fixing Fight Class series on War Notes Conflict Podcast, which is my companion podcast that examines more conventional conflict and probably between the two does a little more conflict futurism than the other. Well, that was a 16-episode series in Fixing Fight Club, which when we had the change in administration in the United States, and full disclosure, I'm a member of neither party, is I thought there was a chance here for us to fix the DOD. I think those chances are winnowing. I don't see the only way to fix the U.S. defense acquisition system, which I suspect, and I say this a little bit tongue-in-cheek, was the Soviet Union 1960s and 70s saying, scratching their heads and saying, man, there is no way we can take down the industrial might of the United States in building not only better weapons, but maybe more weapons, and eventually just consuming our capabilities here in the Soviet Union to fight them to a standstill and prevail. So maybe there was an espionage effort where they said, why don't we give them a Soviet-style acquisition system? So I there was something called the Last Supper in 1993, where then-Secretary of Defense Les Aspin, working for the Clinton administration, reduced, by bringing all the big military manufacturers to this particular dinner, and said, I need to reduce and consolidate all of the defense companies from over 50, I think there were 51 at the time, to under 6. It was a consolidation effort to put all of them under the wing to make acquisition easier. I'm paraphrasing when I say that because anybody who was sober at the time, whether economically or on alcohol, would have said, you know, if you reduce the number of players in a contracting system, not only are you making them larger, but you're making their lobbying efforts more effective, but you're also taking away competition. You're also removing the incentives that are in place, because remember, humans are built on incentives to make things better, to make things more innovative, to take that cross-disciplinary ferment of the mechanical engineer and the chemical engineer going to lunch together one day and saying, you know, an automotive battery, which takes from both of those engineering disciplines, and they would be able to come up with it because of the width and breadth of their expertise in their respective engineering commodity areas. Well, it turns out that wasn't very productive, because here's what we all know, and this is what I know personally, having been in the business for a rather long time, is that, and this doesn't simply apply to defense, this applies to every acquisition and merger within the civilian corporate milieu, is that you purchase a company because of what it did as a smaller, more agile and innovative company and was making loads and loads of money, and then you bring it under your corporate wing. Well, you've got two choices. Number one, you say, hey, we purchased you, but we're keeping the original leadership team, engineering team, finance and contracting team, because you guys did amazing things, which is why we bought you in the first place. So we're going to give you corporate overhead cover, but you do what you think you can do best and keep doing it, and we'll provide you more funding. Or you do what almost always happens. Well, you belong to the larger organization now. Our corporate ecology is going to dominate. Your leadership team is not within the guardrails or left and right limits of the behavior that we enjoy seeing in our peculiar corporate ecology here. So, yeah, we're going to fire the leadership team. And by the way, we're going to fire a lot of the folks who are in there, who made you so unique, as a matter of fact, who brought you to our attention in the first place. I happen to think that the latter, more so than the former, is what has been created in this consolidation since 1993. And I also wanted to suggest that there's this thing in historiography where it talks about great men and great events. Well, which is which? Which is the cart before the horse, as it were? Which came first, the chicken or the egg? And I can think of a wide variety of possible examples where if one significant leader hadn't been in place at the time, and I'm not making the case here where I'm saying that, yep, it's great leaders, it's great men that makes history what it is and not great events that drives that. I'm not proposing that at all. But what I am saying is this. For instance, when you look at Admiral Hyman Rickover, the father of the nuclear submarine force and nuclear reactors in the Navy, if it wasn't for him, I would suggest that there would not be the successful nuclear Navy that we have on the surface and subsurface today. One of my spirit animals from World War II when it comes to the Navy is Raymond A. Spruance. By the way, USS Indianapolis was his flagship. We all know what happened on that flagship when Spruance wasn't on board at the time, when they were torpedoed by the Japanese after delivering very sensitive items that would contribute to a certain August conflagration in Japan that would end that war in the Pacific Theater of Operations. Spruance, extraordinary architect, I would suggest, of the winning hand that gave us the U.S. victory at Midway. Remember, that's 1942. And then he goes on to command flotillas, armada, and a lot of very significant Navy campaigns to a successful conclusion by August, September 1945. Just so happens that one of the reasons why Spruance is my spirit animal is that he is also on the spectrum. He is also autistic, clearly so. When you read books about him or read about his behavior, read about his campaigns, that was most certainly the case. So when I look at Rickover and Spruance and others, I do think that there's something to be said for those men to put America on the road to success in this case when it came to either the hot conflict in World War II or the cold conflict for which the nuclear submarine force in America, which I think is the single most important driver of American martial difference and excellence, bar none from anything else in the inventory of exquisite platforms, that if it weren't for those men, those successes would not have been realized. But here's the worst thing, is that in today's Army and Navy, none of those men would make flag rank. If Ord Wingate, the brilliant British tactician and special operator of sorts in the Burma-India campaigns of World War II, T.E. Lawrence in the brilliant World War I campaigns at the end of World War I, General Leto Vorbeck, the only surviving and successful and victorious German general standing on earth in November 1918 down in German East Africa, and I could name dozens of other personages and luminaries in uniform and not in uniform who would never make it in the current service standards and corporatized military ecology today. The U.S. military doesn't have forward thinkers, futuristic thinkers, who are able to architect a force design that will take America out of the fatal fix that I think it's in. Because I think, and you may have heard me say this before, that America has the most expensive and lethal 20th century fighting force design in the world that is not fit for purpose to prevail and win, whether in stalemate or victory, in 21st century peer warfare. Notice I didn't say near-peer warfare, because I think this whole notion of near-peer and peer, as a result of robotics, hypervelocity munitions, and ISR ubiquity, is a non-starter. And unless something is done to fix it, America is simply going to become an imperial collapse example, much like the British at the end of World War II, or if we went back even further in history, much as all those empires that turned to dust, whether it is the Romans, the Byzantines, or the Persians. So, frankly, I don't think America can fix its acquisition system, and what is downstream of fixing the acquisition system is success in peer warfare in the 21st century. I don't know if there's serious folks pursuing this in the oddly shaped building in D.C. I'm hoping there is. I have sort of faith that there might be, but no one's listening to them. W.C. writes me and he asks, is its military really in terminal collapse? Well, I just so happen to think that, yea and verily, it is. If you want more details on that, look at episode 54 of Chasing Ghost, which I published last October 2024, which was the American military empire in terminal collapse. I go in there in gory and very granular detail on why I think it is absolutely in terminal collapse, and nothing has happened that would change my notions about that. As you know, there's a trifecta that I'm sort of obsessed about, and I just made casual mention of it, which is hypersonics, robotics, and autonomous targeting. Those are the three things between now and 2050 that are going to absolutely consume, ennoble, and make capable military victory between this time and that time. I say between now and 2050 instead of the end of the 21st century, because I find that I don't do prediction, I do forecasting. Forecasting demands a lower evidentiary bar and allows me to fudge a little more. I don't like to make predictions. So when I forecast, I'm sort of like the weather forecasters where, man, they don't seem to get it right probably 90% of the time. Maybe I'm there. I haven't had anybody assess the dozens of forecasts that I have made in Chasing Ghost and War Notes since I started this in 2022. But nonetheless, I do think that there is a democratization that is occurring now that is enabling third world and developing countries to have a domination in the military spectrum that has never been seen before in human military history. Let me make a strange and what seems not even an adjacent comparison, and that would be this. When it comes to Kindle, I have two books published on Kindle and don't make a lot of money with that, but you get a lot of street cred when you have when you're a published author, as it were. What Kindle did was it took the gateways of the overwhelmingly estrogen-laden editors in Chicago, New York, and other big publishing heads, those publishing brands. Those gatekeepers were the ones who have given us this almost absolute collapse, not only of the book industry, and they're not the only reason that that happened, but that's for another episode at some very future time where I'll entertain that question. But I have a lot to say about it. And these gatekeepers had their knees cut out from under them as a result of Kindle and self-publishing. Now, self-publishing's been around for hundreds of years, where somebody could publish their book in hardback or softback, and they felt that they didn't want to go through the gatekeepers of the publishing industry itself, and they've published those sometimes to great acclaim, and most of the time to not so great acclaim. But what Kindle did was it democratized it to such an extent where a guy like myself who doesn't write for a living, who doesn't podcast for a living, yet somehow, some way, I can still publish a book and have it out there and have that street cred, as it were. But the whole publishing industry is rife with a lot of corruption and deflection and advertising the popularity of books, for instance, that don't happen to be as popular as the mainstream media would make them out to be. Now, I use that example because here what we have is, as a result of drones, as I've mentioned in a previous podcast, 80% of all battlefield casualties in the Ukraine, this is Ukrainians, Russians, and whoever else happens to be on the battlefield at the time, have been due to FPVs and UAVs, have been a result of this robotics revolution. And it's driving the price down so much in what America finally calls affordable mass, in air quotes, that they are able to develop wooden drones, cardboard drones, and they are able to achieve economies of scale. The Russians have certainly done this with their Gerunds and other ones, especially with Iranian help, where they are building drones for less than $3,000 to $10,000. Now, when it comes to affordable mass for the United States, they have had this initiative going on for going on a decade. Their first price floor was $300,000. I think it's gone under $250,000. In order for this to count, in order for that salvo competition, which means who can lob the most in this war of leakers so that they can overwhelm the integrated air and missile defenses of those respective antagonists and land in the lap of said antagonists those things that would drive them to their knees and lead to their defeat or stalemate. Well, America is still behind the eight ball. The BRICS nations, Russia, China, Iran, and others who are starting to flock to that flag. I wouldn't say they've broken the code, but they're much further along when it comes to this kind of thing. So do I think, as a result of the concentration on exquisite platforms, carriers, manned aircraft, manned tanks, all the modalities necessary to cross either ocean to get to the front line of troops, as it were, in whatever war of choice America and its allies elect to engage in next. This missile age, this drone age, this UAV, FPV age has not only put those exquisite platforms in the hazard, but for the first time in human history, and I've covered this in previous episodes, those individual infantry soldiers, whether it's a single soldier or a fire team or a squad or a platoon, are now in existential terror at the fact that they can be picked off one by one, and it can be done on the cheap by whoever finds themselves with the number of drones necessary to make that happen. And I want to leave you with this thought. When it comes to missile defense, keep this in mind. This is always going to be, to paraphrase Stalin, where quantity has a quality all of its own, is that for the most part, in a war of leakers, those who can send the most are the ones who are going to be able to reach the beach as far as taking out gensets, fire direction centers, erector launchers, missiles, manned tanks, whatever the case may be. They simply have to overwhelm the kinetic defenses of those organizations so that they can send in as much as they want afterwards and either sink the ship, destroy the missiles, or destroy the exquisite platforms. America is at a crossroads right now. I suspect that savvy individuals in the Pentagon or even the defense intelligentsia in the U.S. and the West have sort of seen this coming for the last few decades, but I see nothing being done to address it. So my answer to the question, is America's military in terminal collapse? My answer is a hearty yes. I have a question from S.L., where he asks, your Storming America series, which has proven to be one of my most popular series that I've done besides fixing Fight Club on War Notes, is the one where I propose that the October 7th, 2023 invasion from Gaza into Israel proper with the terrorist elements, which was airborne and groundborne and infiltration and all types of things. What would happen if a supersized event like that? And I recommended Kurt Schlichter's book on this, William Fortune's book on this. What's it going to look like in America? I try to suggest this proposition. Is there a critical mass of terrorist cells, in this case, to make the math easy, number in 10,000, 1,000 10-man cells that are prepped and ready with Kalashnikovs or maybe even Stoner platforms, rifles, grenades, IEDs, even fake IEDs and things like that? Are they ready to wake up on Tuesday morning and hit whatever part of the infrastructure or the civilian population centers or even military bases and police organizations across the nation? My answer is a resounding yes. I suspect that they're in here. I suspect they're here also as a result of the last administration's immigration policies, which made it so that the, surprisingly enough, ironically enough, the cartels would find it very profitable for very well-heeled terrorist organizations to sneak in folks in that human trafficking arterial from south to north and get them staged in America. The reason why I said that the cartels would be an integral part of this is, number one, the cartels and the Mexican government are married to each other and there's no difference between them, and the Mexican government will do precisely what the cartels tell them to do. And that, whether you acknowledge this or not, it simply makes sense that this drug war that America has been conducting in earnest since 1972 and the creation of Nixon's Drug Enforcement Agency is such that the sophistication of the cartels not only drives them to do the very interesting paramilitary and almost peer military activities we see on display month after month in Mexico proper, but that if you have a cartel organization that provisions drugs and contraband and those kind of things, and then you can join that organization with activities that involve human trafficking, whether for sex or sleeper cells coming in or bringing in immigrant labor and whatever the case may be, you must accept the supposition that east to west, north to south in the continental United States, and I wouldn't be surprised if the same thing were evident in Hawaii, Alaska, and the territories, there is a very deep and wide organization of trafficking arterials through various modes, whether that's aircraft or vehicles, warehouse assemblies, and a paid-for portion of the law enforcement community from the local to the federal level. Remember, there's 19,000 law enforcement entities in the United States that are there to do the cartel's bidding. So even though I published my first episode of that in April of last year, I still contend that tomorrow morning, regrettably, I could wake up, I could see this on the newsreels, and I will not be, I'll be sad, but I won't be surprised. So, yea and verily, I do think that it is inevitable. I think it's much more probable than possible. Is America headed to civil war? This is a question by DZ. Thanks for the question. Yes, I do think so. As a matter of fact, I have a Twitter feed, which is at W. Bupert. If you haven't followed me, please do. I would be honored if you did so. On there, I got to talk briefly with Dr. David Betts. Please look up that name and listen to some of his observations and suggestions for the United Kingdom falling into civil war, which he takes out of the possible column, puts it in the probable column. And this is a fellow who, fortunate for him, I'm so envious, he is an irregular warfare, war studies professor employed by a university in the United Kingdom, and his prognosis and prognostications, I think they are right on the nose. I think that when he takes in all the socioeconomic factors, the immigration factors, the military factors, and this sort of collision that we're seeing in this case in the UK between native indigenous Britons and this massive immigration influx, which by sheer numbers doesn't match the influx that has come into America, but per capita is absolutely enormous. It isn't isolated to the UK. I think that all of the countries in the EU have been taking in an enormous amount of immigrants that has caused quite a bit of unrest and such. And as you know, I'm fond of saying that regional conflict complexes, that there are embers that are oxygenated by war at the larger place. So every time there's a larger war, all of those embers that had been dormant or even cold start to get a little warmer, maybe even heat up. I can certainly see where civil war in the UK is much more probable than possible. I regret that. I'm sad to see that happening. It's not new there. As a result of the 1922 establishment of the Irish Free State, which is the island of Ayr, E-I-R-E, which is that southern seawater gapped island below Northern Ireland, which still remains in possession of the United Kingdom, there was a civil war there between 1916 and 1922, led to the establishment of the Free State. I've covered in very granular detail why that happened in very early episode of Chasing Ghosts when I talk about Michael Collins, but that had been going on for hundreds of years, these kind of civil war narratives and stories that were starting to emerge over the 800-year occupation of Ireland. You can find the same thing happens after World War II in Northern Ireland, which until the accords with Gerry Adams were reached in the late 1990s, the IRA and all the IRA variants were in a very rather low-level civil war between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland, egged on by the authorities in London and what was certainly a civil war there. When you look at the civil war that has occurred, and Spain and France won't acknowledge this, but the Basque separatist and the ETA, who would use the respective sanctuaries during their decades-old war to carve out a Basque state between those two countries, were constantly fighting and using the alleged sanctuary of those respective countries to run away from the authorities and make it so. Civil war can also be a result of rising crime. I think that the number of grenade attacks in Sweden is at an all-time level, and that Sweden may also be the rape capital of Europe, and that when one looks at the demographics point to the immigration influx that has occurred, both legally and illegally. If you go back to what Dr. David Betts was talking about, please, if you get a chance to listen to his stuff, I would urge you to do so. He makes a good case that there are a number of factors here. Those factors would be the grooming gangs and the rape gangs and the Pakistani sexual assaults at the wholesale level that occurred in Britain for decades as a result of this alien group, as it were, invading England and doing the worst kind of things to young English girls. So if we come here to America and ask ourselves, is there a possibility of civil war? Well, we've had two of them. The first one was from 1775 to 1783, because when Paul Revere rode that evening, April 19th, I guess the evening would be just before April 19th, even dawned after midnight, warning that the regulars were out, the lobster backs were out, whatever argo he employed at the time with his British accent, because he was British in the saddle. Hence, I call it a civil war, the Second American Civil War. It'd be 1860 to 65. And there are tens of thousands of books that one can go to find out what were the predicates and the preambles to that Civil War. So now we can fast forward to today and ask ourselves, is Civil War possible, where that Civil War does one of two things? Does it destroy the American empire into a number of different nation states, or are there political competitors within the American ecology that are seeing who can win over the others so that they can take the prize and run the country? So I do think that that going kinetic is possible, not probable. When it comes to the UK, that going kinetic is probable, not possible. And one interesting thing I think here, and I'm going out on a limb here, but I think that Dr. David Betts would agree with me, is that if the UK gets involved in a civil war, that it will expand to the continent because of all the underlying tensions and problems across all the European states, not only as a matter of immigration, but also as a matter of overweening government policy at both the respective country level and, of course, the EUSSR in Brussels, Belgium. And the last question before we close this out. This is from LB. Is there any limit to the number of episodes you can publish for Chasing Ghosts or War Notes? Well, actually, there isn't. That limit will probably occur when I assume room temperature. And when that happens, then of course, CG and War Notes will no longer be. But I look back on this bloodless curriculum for me, this bloodless history for me as an observer and a practicing amateur military historian and conflict futurist, and there really is no limit to the number of episodes that I can publish that examine these kind of things in the future. For instance, I'm reading some books on the assault in 1940 in Belgium of the Fallschirmjäger, which is the German, please excuse the incorrect pronunciation if that's the case, of the German paratroopers and the brilliant seizure they made of three bridges leading into Belgium at the time, which would lead to Belgium falling in a matter of 2 weeks. I just picked up yet another book on Paul Emil von Leto Vorbeck, that general that I had mentioned to you a bit earlier in this podcast, who managed to best over 550,000 Allied troops, and no less than, I think, we'll call the number 50 Allied general officers during World War II, and remained undefeated. Want to do an episode on him. So it is unlimited, and thanks for asking the question. So that concludes this episode of Chasing Ghosts. If you wish to get in touch with me, you can get in touch with me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. I would love to see more comments on my episodes that are published on Substack. So if you could kindly do that, I'd be obliged. And I wanted to thank my listeners, thank my audience. If you get the opportunity to leave stars at your podcast vendor of choice, man, I'd love to have 4 or 5. But you know what? I can't control how many you leave. But I'd love to have you do that on your podcast vendor. And if you go further and you do a narrative review singing the praises of said podcast, then I would be indebted even further. And once again, all you paid subscribers out there, I have 49 of you. Hand on heart, I am so grateful for what you've done, and thanks for parting with your hard-earned money. As you know, you get some special privileges that if one were to become a paid subscriber, you'll find out. So I wanted to thank everybody within the range of my voice. Thanks for listening, and this is Bill out.